Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Figure It, the podcast where we look at the facts and statistics on Cyprus and figure out what it all means. My name is Fiona Mullen and I'm the Director of Sapienta Economics. Today I've brought Elizabeth Kassinis onto the programme. Elizabeth is currently the Executive Manager at Caritas Cyprus. Caritas works with those living in poverty, with the oppressed, the vulnerable, the marginalised, regardless of race or religion. And we shall have a little plug for that at the end. But the hat I've asked Elizabeth to wear for this podcast is her role as Senior Programme and Bicommunal Programme Advisor at the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, in the years when it was funding a great many intercommunal activities in Cyprus via the United Nations Development Programme under what was called UNDP Act, Action for Cooperation and Trust. So welcome to the programme, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for having me, Fiona. It's nice to catch up, especially to talk about one of our favourite topics, which is this sort of quirky and complicated island that we call home.
Indeed. Now, we could talk all day about all the things you did with UNDP and USAID, but I'm going to be selfish and focus on stuff that will help me on an EU-funded project that I'm working on with Meltem Onurkan Samani. I will do a proper episode with her at a future date. But in brief, the project called SEAUP is trying to get ordinary voters involved in rethinking how the negotiations to solve the Cyprus problem are run. So it isn't about trying to get citizens to make decisions on things like rotating presidency or number of troops. It's about how you update the process so that the leaders don't get stuck on exactly these issues at the final mile as they have always done in the past.
So it's sort of bringing those affected by a settlement along.
Yeah, but trying to get them at the beginning, and we're being careful about this. Let's have a look at the process before we get into any substance, because that's a bit too scary for political leaders. So as part of the research in this project, I've been looking into early attempts at generating what I'm calling practical dialogue between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots. What do I mean by practical dialogue? I mean not just let's meet and have a chat and get to know each other, what one diplomat pejoratively called finger painting. I mean, let's meet and get to know each other and try together to solve some common problems that affect both our communities. And there are many instances of this over the past 20 plus years, and I've had some really great conversations with people who ran those. But as pretty much all of them back in those days were supported by USAID, I wanted to get Elizabeth onto the programme to talk about it, and mainly give us some lessons learned on how to support dialogue between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots that actually involves solving problems together, what works, what doesn't work, what pitfalls to avoid, and so on. So let's start, Elizabeth, by giving us a quick rundown of the kinds of things USAID was involved in funding back then, and then perhaps we can shift focus to those initiatives that involved what I'm calling practical dialogue.
Okay. Well, USAID, the U.S. Foreign Assistance Program, has a 40-plus year history, and it took many forms over that time, reflecting where the conflict was. Mm-hmm. So in 1974, we have blankets, we have tents, we have working with an emergency.
Wow.
It then becomes housing estates and schools and hospitals and the handicraft center and vocational training, things to get Cyprus and the displaced back on their feet. And then in the 80s, we add to that a significant amount of investment in education. Mm-hmm. So things that became known as the Fulbright or the Cyprus America Scholarship Program, which educated basically, I mean, thousands of people either as undergraduates in the United States, graduate students in the United States, or short-term training for professionals. Mm-hmm. And they were done finding people and supporting educational initiatives on both sides to give people a common experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, at that time in the 80s, there were no tertiary education institutions on the island. Wow. And so most people were either going, if they couldn't afford to go to the UK or to Europe or to the United States, they were going to Greece or to Turkey, mm-hmm. which was a complicating factor in lots of ways. But this was to give, the idea was to give people a common experience and to often try and introduce them to each other over the hard, fast green line at that time.
Yeah.
From there, you also add in a lot of joint infrastructure projects. I mean, by then, the division is starting to create quality of life issues. So mm-hmm. sewage treatment, I mean, all the things, there are lots of good examples that people often talk about. The Nicosia Master Plan, because Nicosia is a divided city. Mm-hmm. We have sewage treatment plants. You have health infrastructure that isn't complete and needs bridging. Mm-hmm. Pila was still an open village, but had a lot of issues.
Right.
And then you start to have cooperation on things that are pretty important. Again, animal diseases, which are even mm-hmm. more relevant today, and zoonoses, and mining waste, and water, and the modeling the Morpho aquifer, and figuring out how you're going to distribute some of these common resources.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of untold and unsung stories of actual practical yeah. cooperation.
Maybe you have to write a book.
People sort of tried. I think that something that's really important, though, is that, you know, in 1998, 2000, you start, we do the first thing, USAID opens the first funding window for civil society organizations in mm-hmm. Cyprus. And again, looking back on it, it was really this idea of letting 1,000 flowers bloom, or whatever the expression is, what do people care about, and how can they reach over the dividing line? Not just physically, but also kind of in parallel. I mean, this was a time, again, where the you couldn't cross.
Yeah.
People weren't crossing. Mm. You know, the reality we have today was very different then. And so, you know, people care about things that we, you know, that shouldn't surprise us, right? They care about how their children are taught and mm-hmm. by whom. They care about how patients are treated in hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, they care whether HIV is being diagnosed and, you know, treatment is available. They care, of course, about the environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mouflon and the monk seals and the turtles and the griffin vultures and, you know, you name it. And they care about expressing themselves either politically about their political views
mm-hmm.
or even creatively. So singing and dancing and cultural things. They care about fighting for the same causes, racism, fighting for human rights, fighting against trafficking and domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
They care about fighting for rights for the LGBTQ community. They care, of course, also, again, about places that are important to them, mm-hmm. monuments, churches.
Because yes. you started all the cultural heritage, let's say upgrading of mosques and churches, which is now essentially being funded by the EU, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
No, I mean, I think cultural heritage is an excellent place. I mean, it's one of the best examples, right? I mean, the early examples, of course, were the huge sites for pilgrimages, Apostolos Andreas and Hala Sultan Tepe.
Mm-hmm.
But then it gets harder. I mean, you know, then it was sort of, how do you make sure that you get at every, you know, village churches and other sites, and struggling against some of the very structural reasons why cooperation isn't possible
mm-hmm.
at a time when not only is money an issue, but the paths, the habits to cooperation and the paths of doing that, getting around very critical issues of law and, you know, whose sites and how do you get, you know, what expertise do you use?
Mm-hmm.
Getting international expertise and making sure that it comes up alongside the two communities and not just substituting for them.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think cultural heritage, again, proves to be, even today, we're seeing it with the Cultural Heritage Technical Committee continuing a lot of this work. It was hard fought. I mean, when St. Mama's, when the work at St. Mama's began in Morpho, or when the work was starting to be done in the walled city of Famagusta on so many of the sites that are just World Heritage sites.
Yeah.
These are sites that the world is concerned about.
Yeah.
Or the mosaics at Soli.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, we can go on. But I think they bring a lot of habits of cooperation, routes to conversations that are delicate and difficult, but not insurmountable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Armenian Church and Monastery in Arbakmet in Nicosia is another example. They brought together it had to bring together the authorities on both sides. It had to bring together the Department of Antiquities. It had to bring in EFKAF. It had to bring in the Armenian community, which is, mm-hmm. again, has so many equities and is so grounded in this, in
mm-hmm.
and international expertise,
yeah.
because it can't be done alone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, all of this to say that there was a proliferation of projects, and a lot of them took very strong root. We have, you know, from a wonderfully visionary group of teachers who were concerned about how history was being taught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Association for Historical Research and Dialogue is born, and from
yeah.
that comes the Home for Cooperation.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of us can imagine a world where the home doesn't exist and the home isn't the hub of all of the activities that it has become. I mean, we would be lost without it.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
it came from a dream of people who needed to meet, discuss, talk, create, establish.
Right.
I think youth camps is another really good example
mm-hmm.
where you can change, you know, people's entire lives based on a sort of formative experience. The youth camps, cultural heritage, we've talked about the emergence of think tanks. papers. I mean, I think you, Fiona, too. I mean, not to make it personal, but I mean, you were involved in some of the really early nascent discussions about what does the economics of the settlement look like? How do we start to pick apart some of the issues that are pretty important? And then later on, of course, there's a discussion. I mean, once there's a discussion of how to address the disparities that were complicating a settlement, right? I mean, after 2004, the checkpoints are open. There are contacts, Turkish Cypriots, Greek Cypriots, there's crossings. But is there, you know, how do you get real dialogue and how do you actually get at the fact that the two communities don't know each other, but also they've been in different networks. They've been in separate, they not only do they have to find each other, they have to find the world together.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, I would stop there in terms of sort of background.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. So let's start with some of the positive aspects of what you did. What would you say what worked? And I'm thinking, focusing on dialogue and so on. What works if you were advising someone to try and achieve, let's say, practical dialogue today? What would you say the things that worked and are transferable to our current situation?
I mean, I think I would say that the focus has to be on things that people care about and not just things that they have opinions on. A lot of energy, in my opinion, gets squandered talking endlessly about things that are important, but they're not going to affect people's day-to-day life. I mean, one of the examples that I often use is the discussion about, you know, how many FIRs should Nicosia have post-settlement, you know? I mean, again, you laugh, but this gets discussed, right? And everyone has an opinion, and yet lives won't be affected every day by this, right? And we have to trust that when a settlement finally comes, those big issues, they're going to get settled by minds that are bigger than the ones that were. So, I mean, I think another illustrative example was security. I mean, when after the Annan Plan, there was a ton of work, as you know, there were a lot of postmortems of what people thought and how they were feeling and how their visions evolved. I mean, unlike in a lot of places like South Africa or in Northern Ireland, women in Cyprus were less likely, by some significant percentage, were less likely to vote for a settlement than men, which is strange, right? Because generally women are considered peace builders. They are usually considered at the forefront. And when you pick it apart, again, what I took away from a lot of the analysis that I saw was that we define security very differently.
Yeah.
Right? So
it was guns and ammo.
Exactly. I mean, there was how much effort goes into discussing how many armed troops? Is it a platoon? Is it a battalion? You know, is it this? Is it the other thing? And yet when you ask a woman what security meant to her post-settlement, it's about, you know, if I'm going to live in a community that has, you know, of the other constituent state or under, what language are they going to speak? Is the police going to come when I call them? How am I going to resolve? Can I feel comfortable sending my child to school? These are issues that we care about. We spent no time discussing them. And so you don't bring people along with you. Right? I think that would be my, you know, I mean, what do people care about? They care about rural development. They care about, you know, organic farming. They care about road safety, cybersecurity. I mean, you know, you've got to capture people's imagination about what it's going to mean to them for real. What do I care about today as a parent, as a grandparent, as an elderly person, as somebody who's receiving my pension? We have to address those things and not the FIRs, if you ask. I mean, again, that, to take
so
an extreme example.
What people care about, not what they have opinions about. Good lesson.
The other thing I guess I might say is that I think words matter and I think realities matter and I think relationships matter. I mean, I look back, you know, to prepare for our conversation, I was looking back and I think, you know, in 2011 when Marie happened, in the short term, one of the only solutions that presented itself was for the Greek Cypriot grid to get some support from the Turkish Cypriot electricity grid.
Yes.
And this, you know, you'd think this was easy. This was not easy. And it rested on the relationship of two very, you know, again, I think very courageous men at the time who had been working together for years as leaders in their chambers of commerce.
Chambers of commerce,
who were willing to figure out a practical way at tremendous personal expense, I might say, to figure it out. That's a relationship. And that's a relationship born of not just kind of a, you know, we're just meeting because it's cool to meet, right? We're meeting and we're willing to do the hard work to do it. I mean, realities matter. Summer camps, you know, there's a lot of discussion about crossing the green line and how difficult this is. And some people prefer to, some people will cross, some people won't cross. But, you know, you're putting together a summer activity for children or for an exchange. The phones don't work. And so again, or it takes an hour and a half to cross the checkpoint sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I'm a parent. Mm-hmm. Any parent right now generally is not going to want their child to be somewhere where their phone doesn't work. They're not going to want to be someplace, no matter how much they believe, if they can't get in their car and get to their child mm-hmm. in an emergency. Mm-hmm. And so I think, again, we tend to say there was a lot of talk about how well, especially it was in this case, the Greek Cypriots don't like to allow their children to participate in youth exchanges and all of that, or it, less so for Turkish Cypriots because they've had to adapt in lots of other ways. But I think we lose track of the fact that realities matter. Mm-hmm. There is inertia mm-hmm. And there are obstacles, but you know, good design can get over mm-hmm. them. And recognizing for them for what they are, mm-hmm. they're not biased necessarily. They're not disinterest. They're just real. It's hard.
But even people I know who were, let's say, pro-solution space didn't know about the roaming agreement that took something like 5 years to negotiate. So, you know, you can technically get access now when you travel mm-hmm. to the other side. But I didn't know the other day whether I could get... I'm terrible at directions. Mm-hmm. I had to go to Kyrenia and I mm-hmm. Was really scared I was not going to get GPS, mm-hmm. you know, and things like that.
So. Well, no, these are practical things that I think, again, I'm not suggesting I don't have the solutions for them. All I'm saying is that when you're designing a dialogue or a discussion or an activity, sometimes they do shipwreck on things that have nothing to do mm. with the problem.
So be aware of the...
Yes, I think good design matters.
Yeah, yeah.
Good design matters. And I would give you, you know, one of my favorite examples. I'm a huge cultural heritage buff, as anybody who knows me, particularly medieval. And, you know, we did some work in the old town of Famagusta and with, you know, very, again, open-minded. I mean, Mazdur, which is the Walled City Association, and was working with Greek Cypriot preservationists and even the Department of Antiquities. And slowly, slowly, when you find things to talk about, and you realize that expertise is important and everyone cares about whether or not you save Saints Peter and Paul, which is now, I forget, it's Lala, I forget which mosque mm-hmm. it was for some period in time. But, you know, they were willing to get in the car and go and fix, show people how it's done.
Yeah.
And so you had Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots working together, even people who in officialdom didn't have a discussion. They didn't have a formal relationship. And I'm proud to say, I think that's because of good design. Mm-hmm. That if you make it so that you understand why people are reticent, mm-hmm. what are the real obstacles, and find solutions for getting around them.
Right, right.
I mean, I think one of the most important things I would say, Fiona, though, is, and you and I've talked about this before, is holding people accountable. Mm-hmm. You've got to move the ball forward, or at least not move back. Don't lose ground. You know, the Nicosia Master Plan led to, you know, and continues to, in the background, I mean, I think the mayor, I think I heard Mayor Brunsos make a reference to it recently, and of course his discussions with Harmanji are ongoing. I mean, those dialogues led to, you know, being able to fix the Venetian wall when it fell, when the bastion here at the Paphos Gate fell down. Mm-hmm. And we insisted at that time as the funder that you would have Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots work together.
Right.
This was not, you're not going to let a contract to some firm on one side or uh-huh. another. Uh-huh. You would have mixed crews.
Yeah.
That led to the sort of then the big, huge survey that was done in the buffer zone, again, by mixed crews, mm-hmm. which then led to having an entire cadre of people, professionals, you know, planners, architects, engineers, civil engineers, masons, stoneworkers, mm-hmm. who have an experience of working with someone from the other side, someone right. with whom they're going to be neighbors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a real, that is the foundation on which you can build then cultural heritage projects.
Yeah.
The same, we talked about the chambers. I mean, the chambers of commerce, we're talking every 2 months for a period between 2000 and when the Green Line trade regulation came into force until almost the end of some of the projects that we had. They were meeting every second month, mm-hmm. analyzing, going over Green Line trade data, figuring out mm-hmm. why deals weren't happening, mm-hmm. why... To come up now and say, well, let's, trade over the Green Line. To me, I feel like we lost ground. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They've been there, they've done that, and someone, I think they should hold themselves accountable, and they should, you know, respect the work that was done before them. You don't just come along and say, oh, wouldn't it be great to have a one-stop shop to talk about Green Line? I mean, yes, it is. I'm no offense, but you know, sorry, they did that a long time ago. The ball should have moved way further downfield.
I think they're still talking about commercial trucks, which I know for a fact when I was in the technical committee, they were talking about in 2008.
But they have, again, there is a base of solving solutions. Back in the days, the problem was bad check writing. Mm-hmm. If they could figure out, and they did figure out a way to mitigate that, they can figure out the rest. Mm-hmm. But at least don't let, I guess my plea would be not to lose ground, mm-hmm. right? I mean, where did we last leave off? I think anybody who picks up any dialogue now or any thread of activity or, you know, sort of bicommunal discussion, it's not only is it in their interest, but I think they owe it to everything that came before to say, where did we leave off on this? Mm-hmm. You know, who last was discussing mm-hmm. how we're going to deal with pensions post-settlement? I don't know, take mm-hmm. your economic issues, mm-hmm. right? I mean, which model works best for the central banks? I don't know, mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. Pick up the file where it got left. Mm-hmm. Don't sort of assume that no one ever discussed it before mm-hmm. and kind of just, mm-hmm. you know, reinvent the wheel or lose ground. I mean, I think this is why things like the Cyprus Dialogue Forum are so critical, mm-hmm. right? That they're meeting, they meet constantly, they've got a background, they've got an archive, they're making sure that these things are, they with the attempt to sort of kick the ball each time. Mm-hmm.
I think our problem at the moment is there's so little hope that we're going to get, that we're anywhere near starting negotiations, let alone finishing them, that this is why I'm focusing on something else, which is not mm-hmm. day after the solution stuff, but how can we just even have a look at changing the way negotiations are conducted in the first place mm-hmm. and trying to get citizens engaged on that. So we've had a couple of positive aspects, what worked. I'm thinking so proper, good design, so planning properly, understanding that people might be reticent, not only for political reasons, but for practical reasons and so on. Holding people accountable. Are there things, any other sort of pitfalls, what didn't work? And I'm again, especially on dialogue among citizens,
right?
Rather than, let's say, the higher level people. Any mm-hmm. tips on that?
I mean, I guess I would say, I think superficiality doesn't work, right? I mean, I think it's important. Contact theory, it is good that people interact, but I think you have to have a conversation, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I would use the example of all of the cases where people, after their checkpoints opened, went back to their villages and were finding churches being used as cultural centers or as something else. And it wasn't until they actually had a conversation with the people in the village that they realized that that was their expression of trying to save the mm-hmm. space so that it didn't
have sheep fall, in it, you know, or whatever.
The only way this, right, that they meant it out of, I mean, they were disrespecting a church, perhaps, from the perspective of the parishioner. Mm-hmm. But in their mind, they were actually trying to, by using it every week as a cultural center or dancing in it or something like that, was better than having it fall into disarray mm-hmm. and collapse. Mm-hmm. So again, I think you have to have a conversation beyond mm-hmm. just what you're mm-hmm. seeing. The second would be, I think, to try and get over the skepticism, right? My grandfather, my British grandfather, used to say that if you want to get something done, you have to ask a busy person. And I think this is true of the bike
movement. That's why I asked you.
Right? This is. thank you. That's a compliment. But I mean, I think that's why we keep talking about, you know, the usual suspects, which I think is so unfair. Mm-hmm. Right? These are people who are committed. And I think it just allows for cheap skepticism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, people get tired and all of that, but I think that's unfair. And then I think that there is a danger to linking things to the formal process. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, the challenge is you need the political push, but the tone is set from the top. Mm. So if you're too close to the political process, you know, you need the ears of the leaders. You need to feel that. But if you're too close and the leaders say back off, then so mm-hmm. you back mm-hmm. off. And the technical committees, I think, in my opinion, having been there when they were conceived, right, the idea was that you would set them off like a top. You know, you would get it mm-hmm. spinning, and then they would attack these quality of life mm-hmm. measures earnestly mm-hmm. and separate from the political process.
Yeah, didn't happen, did it?
Right?
Yeah.
The working groups, you'll remember the working group on economy, the working group on security, they were meant to be linked to the mm-hmm. to the formal process. But the technical committees were meant to be sort of out there. Just get them going and let them go. But you bring them too close and then you start to appoint people. And then, of course, it begins to reflect the talks as opposed to life. Yeah. And so I think that would be one of my cautionary mm-hmm. tale. The other thing is that successes get hidden, right? There's so much scrutiny on bicommunal things and people looking for the wrong word and the wrong use and the placement of comma that, you know, sometimes the best examples get hidden.
Yeah.
You know, the joint task force, the joint crimes, whatever it is, the joint control room, for example, has successes every day, but no one talks about them for good reason. The negotiators went to, I remember, to South Africa to talk to colleagues. They went to Northern Ireland mm-hmm. to learn. I mean, these are things that are really important mm-hmm. and they've informed the process as it's mm-hmm. evolving, but people hide from them because, you know, you can't talk about them.
Can't say we might have some progress. And,
heaven forbid.
So you're more of a distant observer now, I would say. I mean, you're obviously still, I see you at a lot of events and so on, but you're not, let's say, in the weeds on the Cyprus problem as such. But so if I may call you a veteran, from your perspective as a veteran, do you see that things are different now than before? Has anything got better, anything worse? And or dare I ask, is it all depressingly the same?
I mean, I think... you know that I'm particularly frustrated by the fact that the ball feels like it's moved backwards mm-hmm. because we're always reinventing the wheel. I mean, I think it's partly human nature, right? You come into it and you assume that everything before you either didn't happen or wasn't well done. So I think there's that. But I think most importantly, time isn't neutral. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if I look back to 1998, with the first bicommunal development program, or if I look back then to, you know, 2004 with the Action for Cooperation and Trust, or to the Cyprus Partnership for Economic Growth after 2008, I mean, the world's changed. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, since then, paths have diverged, mm-hmm. right, for the two sides. I mean, life goes on. The European Union is what the European Union is. You know, Turkey and the region are what mm-hmm. they are. And the hard work of compromise and understanding is still ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is the problem. I'm not sure that the root cause, that the stuff is still there. I mean, we talk about the people displaced in 1974, refugees, and, you know, some of the people I love most in the world lost everything in the summer of 1974. And I think that's a profound experience. The thing, though, that's different now is that the world now is facing a situation of 117 million forcibly displaced mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. Right? The context that Cyprus is in is just getting even more mm-hmm. complicated, which is not devoid of then complicating mm-hmm. what happens with Cyprus, mm-hmm. right? And positions harden.
Yeah. So you said people were, you had actually officials prepared to cross over for, let's say, archaeological issues. And that mm-hmm. probably doesn't happen anymore, I'm guessing. I'm not completely up to date.
Well, no, but... I mean, Fiona, to me, I think that the most obvious example to me is how difficult it is even for diplomats now to have conversations with Turkish Cypriots.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it used to be commonplace. Yeah. Right. It used to be commonplace that all diplomatic missions would somehow at least pay lip service to meeting with a Turkish mm-hmm. Cypriot official, to maybe not an official, sorry, a Turkish Cypriot professional or someone of, you know, who could tell them about the Turkish Cypriot perspective mm-hmm. on things. I, as you said, I'm not in the thick of it anymore. I don't see it.
Yeah, actually, I think what happened was you had Tatar in power, and because he was saying two mm-hmm. states, then that was an excuse for EU. I mean, they come under pressure mm-hmm. from the Republic of Cyprus not to visit. So,
of course.
And then you get, actually, Julie Fisher went to say goodbye mm-hmm. to Tufan Erdogan. But I think, mm-hmm. yeah, you can count on one hand the number of embassies that do actually meet Turkish Cypriots.
Yeah, and it's just not the same. I mean, again, I think it used to be, you would wonder, what is the Turkish Cypriot perspective? Or what is this issue going to mean for a united Cyprus in the mm-hmm, future, mm-hmm. right? I'm not sure we're having those discussions anymore. Yeah. And I'm not knocking it. I understand the Republic is now, I mean, the Republic right now is the president's, you know, the stakes are mm-hmm. huge. They are now the president of the European Council. They have a tremendous amount of international responsibility. I'm not sure, but this is hard, right? The chasm is just getting bigger. It's not getting smaller. And as the region gets more complicated and Turkey starts to play a very different role, there's a bigger game. And I think that unfortunately just complicates the already complicated Cyprus problem. And so this balance that we need between urgency. I mean, I think the Cyprus problems always needed this balance between urgency and patience, right? You need to feel like we cannot have another day of division. We just can't. This unresolved conflict is just ridiculous. It distorts everything on this island. And so we've got to fix it. But at the same time, you've got to have the patience to do it right, or else you're just buying another problem. But I think that this balance is even harder than it was.
Right around here in the original recording, we had a glitch and I lost my audio for a couple of minutes. So I agreed with Elizabeth that times have changed dramatically, and I said this is why I think we need to really start to engage citizens, not just for the Cyprus problem, but because citizens have lost hope in traditional political parties. They're being tempted away by new, smaller parties, and one of the ways that a lot of other Western democracies have addressed this is through engaging citizens in issues they care about, for example, on end-of-life issues or divorce and so on. I explained that the project I'm working on is not right now on trying to get citizens to solve the hardcore Cyprus problem questions, but to update a process that is over 50 years old and not fit for the 21st century. So let's pick up from where I got my audio back. Yeah, so it's not necessarily at this stage, because I think Cyprus is still a young democracy, so it's not necessarily get them to solve the Cyprus problem, but it is get them involved in thinking about how we've been going about solving the Cyprus problem, because it's not 21st century. it's very old, it's very top down, etc.
No, but you have to have, I mean, look, you have citizen science, right? I mean, you have to, I think that the, you know, technology and social media and whatever, I think the average person wants, they have to be brought along with mm-hmm. you. They have to be vested. And I feel like, again, I would say that I think that for the process to work, you've got to do it. You've got to hold mm-hmm. people accountable. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked about that in different contexts, but I mean also that, I'm sorry, everyone should, not only should you vote, but you should offer your opinion to this process. This process can't be out there anymore, like somebody else's purview, right? I mean, and I think we're seeing it in the way that there's these calls for, you know, quote-unquote direct democracy and all of this, right? People supposedly, right? So we should, I think we should call them on it. Yeah. I mean, I think it's time for the process to say, okay, you know what? The leaders can't do this alone. You can't shoulder this burden alone. Now, they may have been trying, you know, and again, I had the I don't know, the honor of working and watching lots of leaders sort of tackle the Cyprus problem. And I remember conversations even back, you know, with that I got to watch with Glafkos Kliridis and their different philosophies of how you come at the negotiations. Yeah, and I think times have changed. This idea that somehow this deal is going to get done and then we'll sort of sell it based on, you know, kind of numbers it's not going to work anymore.
And it won't be sustainable either, because, you know, what you want is a sustainable solution.
No.
So if you just, you know, they come down from the mountain with their 10 points of the Cyprus problem, as it were, I'm not sure citizens these days would accept it. So.
No. Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think young people, listen to me, young people. I mean, I don't think young people will, nor should they. But by the same token, the flip side of that is you need to speak up. Then you need to get involved. You can't just get to poo-poo it and say, well, it doesn't represent me, or you didn't involve me. And so
getting them
I'm
involved
on the outside of that.
Uh-uh. Requires all the planning that you've mentioned. Okay. So thank you. I normally try and keep these short, but we had a lot to talk about. So thank you for taking time to talk about your old job, as it were.
Thank you.
For your new job at Caritas, if people want to support Caritas Cyprus in its work, how can they do that?
Well, thank you. The best way to do that would be to check out our website, which is caritascyprus.org. And the information is there for donations, for volunteers, and for ways to help the more vulnerable in our community.
Good. Okay. That's it from me. Figure It is brought to you by Island Talks, the only trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. If you want to support the software subscriptions and so on that need to keep it going, it doesn't go to me. Go to islandtalks.fm and click support us. Thank you for listening. And thank you, Elizabeth, for coming onto the programme.
Thank you, Fiona, and good luck with the project. See you in Meltem.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.